Thanks for tuning in for the August 27th podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, section editor of the Neurology Podcast. This week's featured interview highlights a large case control study on vaccination as a risk factor of multiple sclerosis. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an update on Zika virus in 2019. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast. And also, we'd love to hear your feedback at podcasts@aan.com.
This is David Lapidus from the University of Virginia. Today we're joined by Dr. Bernard Hemmer of the Department of Neurology at the Technical University of Munich in Germany. He's joining us today to discuss his paper titled A Large Case-Controlled Study on Vaccination as Risk Factor of Multiple Sclerosis, published in this week's Journal of Neurology. Bernard, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you, in just a sentence or two, summarize the clinical implications of the findings regarding vaccinations and the MS patient population?
So we looked at the relation between vaccination and the onset of multiple sclerosis, and the results of our study did not reveal vaccination to be a risk factor for MS.
Wonderful. That's really powerful. So it's well known that live vaccinations can induce relapses in patients with already diagnosed multiple sclerosis, but your study was rather on the risk of developing multiple sclerosis from vaccination. So can you tell us a little bit about where the MS community stood prior to your study on the relationship between MS and vaccinations?
So prior to our study, the issue of the relation between vaccinations and the development of MS was rather controversial. There were studies claiming that vaccinations would go along with a higher risk to develop multiple sclerosis, and other studies did not show a relation between vaccination and the development of MS.
Great. This was a really large data set, as you mentioned, with a really interesting design using other autoimmune diseases as control. Can you talk a little bit about that design and the ultimate intention of that comparison?
Yeah, so we looked at the health records of patients from the state of Bavaria, which these health records covered 85% of the Bavarian population. And we selected patients who were newly diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and matched them with healthy controls and two additional cohorts of patients with Crohn's disease and psoriasis to address the question whether there are more vaccinations or less vaccinations preceding the onset of MS compared to these three cohorts.
Bernard, this is a really interesting design that helped us to see the relationship between MS and other autoimmune diseases. And can you tell us what specifically did your study find regarding the risk of MS after vaccination?
So when we looked at the 5 years before the patient was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and compared this to the three cohorts I just mentioned with other autoimmune diseases and one comprising healthy controls, we found less vaccinations in the MS cohort during the 5 years preceding the diagnosis.
Okay, I think that's really clear. And this is certainly another element in the work that's been done regarding MS and vaccination. So how do your findings drive the next line of hypotheses for further exploring vaccinations and MS?
So there are two lines that we want to follow. One is, of course, we have only looked at 5 years, and we're now working on a study where we look at much longer time frames. So we don't know what happens 10 years or 15 years before. So we would like to investigate that to see whether vaccination years ago or during childhood have an impact on the onset of multiple sclerosis.
I think this data is really important for a clinician who can, don't let me put words in your mouth, but safely say that currently the data that is put forth in your paper does not support the relationship between a recent vaccination and the development of MS, which is a common question that we receive in the clinic.
Yeah, that's true. We have no indication that vaccination at this point drives the onset of multiple sclerosis during the next 5 years, and there's no reason not to undergo vaccination if it's necessary.
Wonderful. That's a really strong finding. Bernard, can you just give a final parting message for our podcast listeners?
Yeah, so according to our studies, people should not be afraid undergoing vaccinations that can protect their life. There's no indication that they would lead to multiple sclerosis, according to our findings.
Bernard, thank you so much for joining us again today, and I encourage all of our readers to check out this week's article, A Large Case-Control Study on Vaccination as a Risk Factor of Multiple Sclerosis, published in this week's Journal of Neurology. Thanks again.
This is Stacey Clardy from the Salt Lake City VA and the University of Utah. We're talking today about neurologic sequela of Zika virus infection, specifically in pregnant women. So we're talking today with Dr. Amanda Grinnell. She earned her doctorate in chemistry from the University of Colorado Boulder and was recently the PBS NewsHour's 2018 American Association for the Advancement of Science, Mass Media, Science and Engineering Fellow. And she wrote a great piece on Zika virus updates for PBS. So thanks for joining us today, Amanda.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
We've been covering Zika on the Neurology Podcast as far back as 2016. We actually had a cluster of episodes between July and September 2016 when this was sort of first becoming widely recognized. But at this point, we know a lot more. As I understand, more than 500,000 people have contracted Zika in the Americas in the last 4 years. So let's start out with some important questions. Can we still travel to these beautiful areas of the world where Zika has been reported? And by can we travel, I mean all relatively healthy adults, but also including women of childbearing age. And what regions are now considered most risky or endemic?
Yeah, so I would say that most healthy adults are free to travel. The main travel restriction is for women who are currently pregnant or who are thinking about becoming pregnant. And that's because Zika has been shown to really severely affect the neurological development of the fetus. And so the CDC currently recommends that women who are pregnant do not travel to areas at risk for Zika. And that's a lot of areas, actually. The CDC maintains a really great map on their website with areas that have a risk of Zika. And I mean, like right now, basically all of South and Central America has a risk of Zika infection. And there's also a significant chunk of Central Africa that also has risk, as well as Southeast Asia. And so people who are traveling to these regions should be considering Zika if they're thinking about pregnancy. And that includes people who are partners of women who are pregnant or who are thinking about becoming pregnant, because Zika is a sexually transmitted disease. And in fact, there have been a little over 50 cases of sexually transmitted Zika in the U.S. so far. The CDC has all sorts of recommendations for people who are pregnant, thinking of becoming pregnant, or partners of people who are pregnant, and what to do if you have to travel to these countries.
Wow, yeah, I didn't realize it was so many places. When you say thinking about becoming pregnant, does the CDC provide guidance on how long it should have been since you were in one of those regions before you conceive?
They do, yeah. It's actually 2 months for women and 3 months for men, because Zika virus has been shown to persist in sperm for longer. So for men, it's 3 months.
When I was reading your report, I was startled by the overall number of infants who have been impacted by maternal Zika infection. I think most of us knew about the initial tragic reports of children with microcephaly, but it seems now you're finding out that exposed babies who are followed over time have an entire spectrum of health problems that have been uncovered. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that is something I found very surprising when I was doing my reporting on Zika last summer. So yeah, the CDC published a pretty extensive report last August where they studied a little over 1,400 infants in the U.S. territories, and they followed these infants for at least a year after they were born, after they'd been exposed to Zika during pregnancy. And apart from microcephaly or other birth defects, they found that there were a significant number, like 9 to 10% of babies who had other developmental problems that wouldn't really be caught when they were first born. These are things like hearing problems, vision problems, sometimes epilepsy, developmental delays, a lot of different developmental problems because of how Zika can attack neural cells. And so Zika has been shown over the past couple years of research to attack neural progenitor cells, as well as early developing or even intermediately developing neurons. And so these problems can persist over time as an infant develops.
Wow. So what should we do as clinicians when we suspect a mother may have been exposed, or if we're seeing a child for the first time, we suspect that they may have been exposed?
There are two different things that I think are really important for clinicians here. One is reporting of Zika infection. Reporting of that information for research purposes is really important. That's what made the CDC study possible. And it can help the parents and clinicians know what to expect as their child develops. So that's a really important thing. Clinicians can report these things to the U.S. Zika Pregnancy and Infant Registry. That's what the CDC has set up, as well as local health departments. The other thing that they should do is ask about potential Zika exposure, and that includes, you know, travel of the mom, but also of partners of the mom, and also do these assessments that are now being recommended by the CDC after birth as the baby develops.
So you're essentially saying, don't just make a note of it, that we should be reporting and following these children up, especially, and maybe getting more resources in early?
Yeah, exactly. So if there is a problem that's discovered, there are things that can be done to help the child develop more quickly than, you know, if you don't catch it early on. So for example, hearing, if a child has a hearing problem and you don't know about it until they're a year and a half, 2 years old, that's going to affect how they are learning language. And instead, if you kind of learn about it when they're 6 months old, then there are things that can be done to help with the hearing problem so that their language skills don't fall behind.
Great. So that is important. And maybe we should all be paying a little more attention to our travel history in light of the fact that so many regions of the world are affected. Is there any thought on if the spread of Zika will continue to grow, or is this virus sort of running its course and maybe it's peaked in terms of number of cases? I guess really I'm saying, do we understand why this virus, which really has been around for decades, suddenly emerged a few years ago?
Right. Yeah. This is a great question. And I asked this to like everyone when I was reporting. And it's still kind of like a, we don't know yet. There are a lot of things that we know about other similar viruses. And so we kind of can speculate. So Zika is a flavivirus. And there are other ones like dengue and West Nile and Japanese encephalitis that we've dealt with in the past. And so we can kind of look to those to see if Zika will continue to grow or if it's peaked. I will say that it certainly seems like there are fewer cases than around 2016, where there were hundreds of thousands of cases in South America. But that doesn't mean that we know what it's going to do in the future. So like dengue has a surge at a certain time every year and then dies off when the vector, the mosquitoes population goes down. Japanese encephalitis has a high number of cases every year, actually. And so that could be a possibility for Zika in the future. West Nile is one where it's kind of periodic outbreaks every 5-6 years. I think that people have ideas about why it's emerged now. It was something that we've known about since the late 40s. What we do know is that the structure of the virus has changed since the 40s. So the Zika outbreaks now are of a mutated form of the virus. And so likely that mutation made the virus more virulent. And so that is part of why we're seeing it now. But there are other factors like the vector, so mosquitoes that are transmitting the virus, the climate that supports the mosquitoes, and the host for the virus. And so I don't think people know for sure why all of those things kind of came together to create an environment where Zika could spread. But we do know that it has mutated. And so that might be the biggest reason why it has emerged now.
So the jury's still out. What else do we need to know about Zika or even other arthropod-borne viruses?
You know, these viruses depend on their arthropod vectors, and, you know, that can be really dependent on the environment and the time of year. And so in the continental U.S., at least, you know, all the cases of Zika in the past have been in usually the summer when the mosquito populations are up. And so the outbreaks that have happened in the past, you know, Texas and Florida, but the mosquito that carries Zika has also been found in California. And so in these places, we will be on the lookout for all sorts of mosquito-borne diseases. And in the U.S., we have pretty good methods of keeping those from spreading. But something that I keep thinking about that isn't necessarily just about this year, but more about the future, is climate change. And as weather continues to warm, and we also continue to have more frequency and more intense hurricanes and flooding, the number of people that mosquitoes can infect will increase. And so That's a really interesting thing to look at and think about for the future, is that the way that the climate is changing, these diseases are going to have higher rates. And there are other things we can be doing to address them. One of the really interesting things for the flaviviruses like Zika, how to control the mosquito population. And so there's a program called the World Mosquito Program that's been testing an approach where they infect mosquitoes with a bacteria called Wolbachia, and that prevents the mosquitoes from transmitting dengue. So we think that maybe this would work for other flaviviruses like Zika. And so they're actually testing in all different countries right now. And there's also ways that we can kind of limit mosquito populations directly after a hurricane or a flood when there's a lot of standing water around and the mosquitoes need standing water to lay their eggs. And so there are programs that we can put in place where we can limit the mosquito populations immediately after a flood or a hurricane.
Well, thank you very much, Amanda, for updating us on the latest research related to the Zika virus. We may have to check back in with you. Hopefully it's a quiet year internationally, but I suppose we don't really know.
Yeah, that is the thing. We don't really know. And, you know, the more reporting we can have to do excellent research on Zika and how it's affecting people, the more information we'll have for the future.
This is Bob Gross. Each week, you hear from many clinicians, scientists, and journalists from around the world. What isn't talked about is all the hard work behind the scenes each week to make the podcast happen. All that work's done by our staff, so thanks go out to Justin Doherty, Rachel Anderson, Madeline Sendek, Rima Murphy, Samantha Ewert, Andrew Lucas, Caitlin Ram, James Owens, Robert Kosky, and Patty Baskin. Thanks again.
This is Stacey Clardy. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting paper looking at declining malformation rates with changed antiepileptic drug prescribing, and another article on hemoglobin and anemia in relation to dementia risk and accompanying changes on brain MRI. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.